Good afternoon. It's lovely to see you all here. My name is Anna Ambrose, and on behalf of Design Centre Chelsea Harbour, I'd like to wish you a very warm welcome to our Conversation in Design series. Just before we start, if I could ask you to turn off your mobile phones, that would be great. Thank you. We are thrilled our conversation this afternoon has been hosted by Living Etc. It is the one-stop edit of the best modern style inspiration and design ideas. And I'd like to introduce the magazine's executive editor, Neil McLennan. We are delighted Neil is joined today by three designers who bring a fresh approach to decorating. Georgina Cave, Charles Bateson, and Nicola Harding. Please do join me in giving them a very warm welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Anna. Welcome to Design Centre Chelsea Harbour and this afternoon's Conversation in Design, where we will be drilling down, mulling over, or just generally having a chat about distinctive interiors and how to decorate with a difference. My name is Neil McLennan, and I'm the executive editor at Living Etc. And I'm delighted to welcome to the stage this afternoon's panel of esteemed industry experts who have all, I guess, made their names as being for sort of throwing out the established rule book and producing work that's creative, original, and full of individual flair. On my immediate left, I have Georgina Cave, who started out as a fashion photographer and a specialist painter before finding her métier in interior design. She founded Cave Interiors in 2002, where she has a hand-picked team who work on high-end homes and interiors projects, yes, both in the UK, yeah, and abroad. She prides herself on developing highly creative spaces that bear the signature of the client rather than the designer. In the middle, we have Charles Bateson. Charles started out working for the legendary designer David Hicks, and I'm sure he could probably fill a session talking about that on its own. But he then went on to found his own company, and he has worked for private clients and on estates in Inverness-shire, in the Cotswolds. He's done a new build in Cairo and a bespoke teak junk in Hong Kong. His studio undertakes everything in-house, from joinery and lighting design through to furniture and furnishings. He is also an interior product designer in his own right, and he works for a variety of manufacturing companies. And on the far left, we have Nicola Harding. Her company, Harding & Reed, focuses on people and their experiences of a space. She's turned her hand to boutique hotels, restaurants, coffee houses, new developments, townhouses, and country retreats. But the end results all have one thing in common. They are spaces full of integrity, character, and they reflect and fit the people who use them. So, ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome to this afternoon's panel. I think to start with, it's fair to say that everybody in the room here craves to have the kind of home that's beautiful and welcoming, but at the same time has a very strong, distinctive feel of personality. But that's a very difficult thing to achieve, because one person's personality is another person's quirky or hard to live with. So perhaps we could start by talking about how do you go about building a scheme or a decorating scheme that's sort of eye-catching, but goes beyond the predictable, and is also beautiful and comfortable and easy to live with. Georgina?
I'd say, for me, it's always about being timeless, but maybe giving it a little bit of a twist. So I don't really like creating rooms that are on trend, but more about doing something that creates a space for the person that they feel really comfortable living with, but you can look on in 10 years' time and it's still looking really lovely. And there's ways of going about that, and often it's by doing something, by mixing materials, so things that maybe are a bit unexpected. So the modern with the old is a favourite of mine, and also, just mixing pattern and colour, and, you don't have to, you can do pattern on pattern, which is obviously very, very... it is actually on trend now, but you could do it by using accessories and stuff like that, so it doesn't have to be something that's fixed and permanent, basically.
Mm-hmm. Charles?
That was very well put, actually.
Thank you.
The first job I ever did, which was 20 years ago, is still as it was when I left it, which is nice, because quite often if you do a job, particularly in London, you'll drive by 5 years later and see that it's been ripped out and a completely different thing put in, which is always a bit sad, but that's still the same. And I think it is the same for the reason that you said, and that is that I took a brief from the client, listened to what they were interested in, put some of myself in it, and came up with something which suited the architecture of the house, suited the client, suited me, and then we all like it. And then there's no need to suddenly look at it and go, it looks a bit dated, because it really doesn't. Yeah. You know. And I think that's a trick which you have to learn how to do. And if you do it, then you end up with something that has the longevity that you would like it to have.
Nicola.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I think it's about the design feeling authentic, that it genuinely belongs to the building and to the personal stories of the people who live there or who use the space. Mm. And if you get that bit right, then it's not going to date, it's not going to feel contrived and lose its relevance. So, yeah, I think if there's an honesty to it, and there can be a playfulness as well, which I think also needs to reflect the characters of the people who use the space, and that's where the sort of interest comes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the whole concept of using an interior designer, you can go to a school and you can learn the rudiments of design, which is all about mixing colour and pattern and texture, but what people often crave is that sort of je ne sais quoi, that little special element. How do you find that? Where does that come from?
Well, I don't think you can learn to have that flair. I think you've either got it or you haven't, and I think you have to have a true passion for what you're doing. Get me in an interior shop, you'll have trouble getting me out. Get me in a clothes shop, sometimes I don't know where to start. So I think that is really, you know, it's not something you can learn, but having said that, any good designer, you do need to learn the tools of the trade, and studying and learning that is crucial so that you can implement your ideas in a cohesive and organised fashion, really. So
is it about taking the basics and then twisting them? Or
yeah, I mean, I disagree a little bit with what you said,
actually. Okay, that's good. Okay.
I very much believe that it is something that can be learnt. You know, I think that there is a sort of having an innate flair is a great start. And there are probably some people who will always struggle, but I think there's a big chunk of the bit in between where the more you're exposed to design and the more that you understand craftsmanship and the more that you learn about the history of style and why things were done in the way they were done and what fashions followed what and what came after them, then it all starts to make sense. And then I think that does breed a good designer.
Oh, I definitely agree with that, definitely, because you're never going to stop learning. I mean, I always think that the more places you visit and stuff like that, I'm still learning, and I've been in the industry for a very long time. So you definitely still learn. But, you know, it's a bit like, I've got a scientist for a client. She's absolutely a dream, but I couldn't do an experiment for toffee.
Yes. So, more of an aptitude.
She can't visualise or do anything like that, and she can't learn this. So that's really more where I was coming from. But yes, I agree. So,
Mr. Bates?
I mean, I think my biggest source of inspiration these days is working with people who are extremely good at doing one thing, like craft, for instance. And I would always use the example of a Vera Glamise artist I work with called Emma Peascod. And that's all she does. She does painted and gilded glass. But you just go to her and say, right, I want to do this room panelled and I want the upper panels to be in that. And she'll just come up with a sample and you go, oh, my God, that's amazing. Right, we're doing it. That's game over. So, you know, you draw other people into your world of creativity. It's never just about you. It's
Absolutely.
About... working with other people and sort of creating a team. And we all have our little specialist people that we keep hidden away in our back pocket. And it's not just those clever people like that. It's sometimes people that are just very good at doing joinery and can do something that nobody else can do. One of the things which you might see on one of the slides is I had to do this bar in a turret of a castle. And I wanted to do this faceted mirror. And as a designer, you go, I know, I want to do a faceted mirror, but I only want them to be that wide. And you don't really realise how difficult it is to do that, because you have to bevel each piece of mirror. And it turned out there was really only one or two people that could actually even do that.
Oh,
and you have to throw away one for every one you make. And it, sometimes it's about not seeing the limitations and almost sort of being in denial of the limitations, and that's what makes you do something that nobody else has done before. And so I would say that the inspiration comes from all sorts of places. It might be the building, it might be the client, it might be a craftsman. And it's just being open to ideas.
Yeah.
I'm interested in how you work with the client when they come to you wanting... They want something distinctive, or they want something that's very individual, and they sort of these—they use words like unique and special that kind of sound emotive, but very hard to define actually what they want.
Yeah.
Do you have any special techniques of sort of drilling down and finding what they're really looking for?
I think, first of all, the most important thing for me is really developing a really good relationship with the client and getting them relaxed and sort of really, you know, engaged in what we're doing. Very often as well, I mean, you can use different tools to get them sort of showing you things that they like and dislike, because I think likes, the dislikes are just as important as the likes.
Absolutely.
I mean, so,
yeah.
I mean, I just, it's just, I always say to a client, don't worry about telling me what, you know, you don't like something, because actually I'll learn something from that, and that's really good, and I obviously want to make sure that you love everything we do. So, but often the way we drill it down is by asking them to maybe, you know, give us some tear sheets for magazines or something like that, but write on it, what is it in that image? Because it could just be the floor or the bath, or it could be an amazing pattern or you know, something quite intricate that they've seen in that. And then as you go through, you see a pattern. And, of course, nowadays we've got Pinterest and Instagram and all these things that people use. So it's all really helpful.
Yeah. Nicola?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think talking, asking people the same question, perhaps worded slightly differently several times, you know, by the time you've asked it for the third time, then you'd start to get the real answer. Really exploring with them how they live their life, how they'd like to live their life, you know, how do they spend the weekend? What's their favourite way to spend an evening? How do they connect with their kids? And then, you know, the design needs to be really user-friendly to how they live. And so understanding how they live is key to good design.
Yeah, it's interesting, the process of extracting information from clients, because... as you say, some of them are incredibly articulate about what they want, and, you know, some of them aren't. And, you know, I think a lot of designers, when they're younger, think, oh, I wish I could just have carte blanche to do what I like.
Yeah.
And I personally, as a designer, I've had clients that have said, look, I don't really know anything about this, you just do whatever you like. And I've found those the less than interesting projects, whereas sometimes clients... can end up pushing you further than you thought you could possibly go. And taking a brief it's not just a thing that happens on one day. It does tend to happen over a period of time.
Do you ever get clients who are particularly fixed on something they absolutely want and you sort of think, it's not really going to work?
Yeah, I mean,
what do you do?
one of my most long-term... I do have quite a few clients who... they're almost like... clients for life, you know, hopefully. And I always think of myself as being very open to what they want to do, and I enjoy incorporating what they are suggesting. But one of my clients, she said, oh, you're giving me the look. And I was like, what look? When I suggest something that you don't think is going to work, you give me the look. And I said, well, I'm sorry if I do that, because I don't do it on purpose. But, you know, you have to know really when to say, look, that's a great idea maybe for another project or another building, but not this one, you know. So you can't just say yes to everything, you know.
Yeah, and maybe understanding where they're coming from. You know, they think that they want this, but if you unpack it, it's that they want to create a certain atmosphere, or that thing reminds them of somewhere that they loved on holiday. And once you can understand that, you can create that feeling or trigger that memory or whatever it is in a different way that's perhaps more appropriate to the building. Or
I think
go on.
Oh, I think it's quite dangerous sometimes as well if they don't give you any brief, because you really do need to understand how people live and how they're going to use the spaces as well. So having carte blanche could be a little dangerous in my mind. But
it's interesting that you mentioned Instagram.
Yes.
Because there's this whole phenomenon that everybody's now on Instagram and Pinterest and things. We all sort of have a visual idea of what's good, whether that's relevant or not. Is it good that the clients, the general public, are able to sort of speak a type of design language, or is it a bit of a restriction for you that you'd rather have them sort of not knowing quite so much?
I don't think you can have too much information from anybody, and your job is often more like a certain aspect of your job is like a conductor or an editor, and it's just, you know, sorting everything out and putting things together that do work. Yeah, the first time I saw Instagram, I was like, what's this? It's just lots of pictures. I mean, how is that anything? There's not much words, you know. And now, of course, I actually do use it as a design tool, because I put things in there, and I almost put together looks in there. And so I'm total convert to it now.
You can also find some really... I've actually found some really amazing suppliers through Instagram as well, which is actually really lovely.
Yeah.
And they get their voice out there in a much, you know, people you might never have met or thought of. So I think it's great. But, from the client point of view, I don't know... I've never really experienced that they sort of really understand the process well just because of Instagram myself. I've not picked that one up. But what they might do is come with some ideas of their own, which is very interesting, definitely.
Yeah, no, I think Pinterest probably is the one that's... Yeah. And, you know, if clients put together a Pinterest board, and sometimes that surfaces stuff that they haven't talked about, and you suddenly realise, gosh, you're obsessed with storage, but that hasn't come across or you say you want a sleek kitchen, but all the kitchens you've pinned feel very shaker, so you know, what people think they want and actually gravitate towards can be quite different, and it can demonstrate that.
I'm interested in how you've built your own businesses, because all three of you are quite mindful of putting the client first and making the finished product all about them and their brief. But of course, when you're building your own eponymous business, you've got to create sort of a language of your own that people are buying into.
Yeah.
How do you sort of square that? There's a bit of a conundrum there.
How
do you make that work?
It's true. But I think one thing that I found is that the people who come to me have come to me for a reason. And then they first of all, it most definitely is because it comes across that a lot of our projects are quite different from each other. Which hopefully you can kind of see from some of the images that are coming up on the screens here. But also because they see something in there that draws them to us. So there is a signature, whether we like it or not. I used to kind of think, oh, no, I don't have a signature.
Yeah,
I'm always all about the client. But actually, there is something. And I've come to realise that there's definitely something that they see and they pick it up. It might be my mix of old with new. It could be different use of tiles, which, again, you could see in some of the images. I like using quite unusual tiles where I can, and something colourful. So maybe it's that I will bring something to the project that they wouldn't be able to perhaps do just on their own.
Yeah, when I first started my business, it was like more than 20 years ago, and just by luck, I was asked to design a room in like a show house exhibition in London. And having worked for other people, a couple of other people before, and done all sorts of things, I suddenly realised, right, you've got to decide what your style is.
Yeah.
Because even though, or at least not so much my style in a bigger way, but you've got to design one room, and it's got to be something you can really stand by. So I was very much into 30s, 40s, European sort of deco stuff at the time. And then I did that. I mean, I gave it a whole different angle as well. But I thought, I've got to really pin my colours to the mast now. And, you know, because I'm doing one room, and this is where I get to showcase what I do. And I've just been used to working within the style of the other companies I've worked for. And it was a very lucky thing for me that I was asked to do that, because it meant that I really had to decide today, what are you about? And then I had to get on and do it pretty fast. So that was useful. And I think that I think it's really important to do that as a designer, because otherwise, you know, I think we're going to sort of talk about trends. But if you are really just looking out in the market in Instagram, okay, what's the trend? Then you're always going to be a follower. And, you know, you kind of have to be a bit of a leader if you have your own company.
Yeah, absolutely.
To a certain extent, anyway.
I agree very much with what you've both said already about, you know, I think inevitably there's a thread that runs through work, but I hope that as much as anything, it's the method that we do things that people are drawn to. All our work is word of mouth, so people tend to have seen something and liked it and want something of that for themselves. But I think the very process of getting to know the client and the building and the location, you know, means that each project becomes very distinctive in its own right.
And it's not all about the look. I mean, the professionalism about how you issue your information, about how, you know, just to the builder, and how you agree everything, write it down so that you've always got this way of saying, no, that's what we said we were doing. And that is a word-of-mouth thing.
I think that's absolutely right. So it's very easy to imagine that sort of 90% of what we do is creating a nice look. You know, you'd hope that design professionals would do that naturally. And people are coming to us with their life savings. We're working with them to create the home where they're going to raise their children. It's the face that they put out to the world. And how you handle that and respect them and are sensitive to them, I think, is just as important as what it looks like.
It's an enormous responsibility, actually, dealing with people and their homes. It's very personal. And
very
also
intimate.
Working with the people, too, not just them, but as you say, you know, working with the contractors and the different specialists, it's really important to maintain really good relationships. And also, another thing is always keeping your client calm. You know,
holding
making
their
sure
hands
that as
through it.
Exactly, that's exactly. Actually, I always use that. I'll hold your hand through it. You'll be fine. Yeah. And very often when they're panicking, you know, you might get a panicked email on a Friday night. Oh my gosh, I just went to site, and they're seeing the design just sort of coming together, but they can't visualize everything
the
we've all
points,
discussed.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I kind of say to them before that process now, just remember, it's a slow process on site, but we planned this really well, and it will develop, and it will be exactly how we talked about it. So, you know, that's quite unnerving, particularly when you're using strong colours or textures or something a little bit out there.
No, I think it's traumatic for people to see a house that they've spent a great deal of money on be raised to the ground and have faith that it's all going to come together.
I mean, I love that bit, when it's all destroyed.
Yeah, we love it.
And the clients go, oh, my God, my house. And you go, it's exciting, isn't it? And they go, no, it's not. It's terrifying.
I'm fascinated by trends, actually, because, you know, as a journalist, we're always looking for, well, the magazine, we're always looking for the new thing. But there's always a slight contradiction with homes, because nobody buys a sofa every 6 months and nobody buys into, like, the new look. What are your thoughts on, you know, trends, and should we be following them or should we be ignoring them? Charles, I know you've got strong views on this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, trends are a new trend, basically. I mean, they just didn't really exist 20 years ago to any real degree. The market is so much more sophisticated now than it was when I started. I mean, I can't even begin to. There's more of it. There's more of everything. There's so many more trade fairs now. So many more showrooms. When I first started, there was only about 3 or 4 showrooms at Chelsea Harbour. It was it wasn't even a design centre. It was a shopping centre that happened to have a few interiors showrooms in it. And it's gone completely full circle. Completely to the other end of the spectrum now, and I like eccentric individual approach to design, and I think there is a certain element of people who are sort of blending things out with their own look, you know, obviously not really mentioning any names, but I think it's a shame in a way that that's an effect that trends have had. But it's pretty broad now. You know, you get people who are all about colour and pattern on pattern. Somebody like Kit Kemp, who I admire greatly, right through to people who do very monochromatic things. But I think it's the variation that's important, and so it cuts both ways on trends, I think.
I love the fun of trends, you know, fashion, you know, whether it's in interiors or you know, what we wear. But, yes, I want to know that what I'm putting into a property is of a really high quality. And I think if it is, then the trends can come and go, but it holds its value, you know, probably financially, but also it's always going to be intrinsically beautiful. So I think, you know, trends are great fun to get new ideas and meet new makers, but not to be driven by them.
Yeah,
I would agree. I always think about, I mean, when you talk about trends, I always think about Coco Chanel, because she said, but she's quite famous, her famous quote, wasn't it, that she said, fashions fade, but style remains the same.
Yes.
And I think that really there's real resonance in that.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of brings us back round to one of your first question, that timeless interiors are great, but you can update your home, you can change your cushions, you can buy a different lamp and stuff like that and make it on trend, or that little bit of wicker furniture that seems to be everywhere, or do you know what I mean?
You can
do that, and it's lovely. And it doesn't have to stay, but doing it in a permanent way is, you know, with something that's fixed, like tiling or flooring or something like that, you want to be a little bit more careful.
Yeah, and it's like how you would dress, probably. You have your really good basics, you know, and then you accessorise with the sort of fun stuff
exactly.
that can come and go.
Yeah.
I mean, this week, for people who've been around, there's been an awful lot of talk about maximalism being the new thing. Now, I'd wager that minimalism is probably the sort of less is more is probably a much easier look to pull off, that more is more could become just a hot mess without careful treatment. What are your thoughts on making maximalism work or be beautiful?
I think they both have their challenges. You know, if you take someone like John Pawson, you know, getting all those little negative shadow gaps and perfect stuff that lines up is incredibly difficult on site. But then on the other hand, you know, when we do schemes which have got a lot of pattern and a lot of colour, and you've got to get just exactly that right trim that goes with that colour, and, you know, that's a difficult thing. And every time I do the furnishing scheme in that style, I kind of think, oh, I can't do it this time. It's just too much. Just a bit to whole house. We've got to coordinate everything with everything. And eventually you do it. But it's there's just a lot of work in that somehow.
And also it's that sort of curated look of something that's been there for perhaps 20 years or collected through generations, but actually you've got to put it together within, you know, a short time span to give that look.
Yeah,
that's a challenge.
Very, very, very often that is a challenge, working with people's actual existing belongings and stuff like that. Although art can be a wonderful thing to work with, because that can lead the design beautifully. But the maximalism, I rather like it. Minimalism, it's a little harder to live with, but I totally agree. It's quite hard to execute really well, but you know, I think anything in the interior world, you know, has to be done perfectly. So
good cupboards, apparently somebody said to me once, is what minimalism really needs.
Really good cupboards.
Lots of cupboards and drawers.
And actually, I think maximalism needs it too. You know, you don't want all your stuff.
Your gas bill out.
You know, I had one client who had an entire room racked out with shelving. And it was all done alphabetically. They were a little bit kind of obsessed with that. But I think it's not a bad idea, you know, so that you know where your batteries are and where your,
We did one quite minimalist house quite a number of years ago. It's quite unusual for me. But I could say you get into the vibe of the client, and we did it. But, you know, you had to have your shoes off in that house. You know, so when we were doing all the finishing touches, everyone, we were almost scared to breathe. So I do prefer, if I'm honest, creating real homes. So somewhere where people can kick off their shoes and really relax. And so what if the cushion gets thrown on the floor? You know, it should be a house that's lived in and that dogs can run around and the kids can make a mess. It's great. That's a real home.
Yeah, I think it really varies from client to client. We have some clients who, you know, never leave a piece of paper out or a dirty piece of clothing or anything, and, you know, that can be a very pared back look, whereas people who have got lots of kids and dogs and all the rest of it, you know, you wouldn't recommend them having a minimalist house.
Yeah.
I think it's got to feel really authentic. You know, there's nothing worse than a sort of contrived maximalism with all this stuff that feels totally at odds with the people who live in the house. But if you can kind of dig deep and find out, you know, stories from their history, you know, and what their interests are and places they've visited, and put together a collection of things that, you know, really excite them and reflect them, then I think it can really work.
What's been your biggest challenge as a project, whether it's the client or the space or the budget? Charles, what, you know, what has been in your lengthy career, what's been your big piece work that you've managed to turn around and made you proud?
Well, I think when I was asked to do this teak junk in Hong Kong, I don't think it was necessarily the biggest challenge, but it's the job on which I learnt the most, because, you know, having not done any kind of boat before, you soon learn that, particularly on a junk, like, the floor's not flat, the ceiling isn't flat, the walls lean out, and you suddenly have this whole different sort of thing to work with. But, you know, once I'd got over the kind of shock of realising that, it really is just the same as anything else. And that was fun. I mean, doing this house in Cairo, they actually built a hill for it to go on, so that they could see Cairo that way and the pyramids over there, and you could literally see the pyramids from their garden. And in Egypt, they don't have... I mean, at one point, I realised that we didn't have all the light bulbs we needed, so I said, can you take me to a light bulb shop? And we went to a light bulb shop, and they had three kinds of bulb. That was it. And they were all... You know, I was like, OK, so we're going to have to order these and have them sent. They literally... There's so much you can't get there. And... The client, I said to the client, why don't you have your vanity unit made out of one piece of marble, literally carved? Because I thought, if there's anything Egyptians can do, it's like carving marble. Right? And so they did that. But to actually get a 4-meter-long solid piece of marble that thick with the basins cut out, it literally took about 20 people to carry it because it's that heavy. So that was an interesting learning curve. And, you know, I think working in different countries is sometimes challenging and different because they do things in different ways. But I think any big job is challenging, you know, any big job where it all has to fit together. I always say it's a bit like designing a jigsaw, but ordering each piece from a different maker. You know, that's what being an interior designer is really like. Yep. And then expecting it all to fit perfectly when they all arrive.
Yeah.
It really is like that. In fact, it's worse than that, probably.
Yeah. My biggest challenge, I think, was I did a number of years ago a really beautiful historic house called Grove House. There's a picture from it of the bathroom actually coming up. And it was actually a development project, but it was 3 years long because the house had been carved up into offices and was terribly, terribly sad. A big, beautiful Georgian house just ruined. And I was tasked with the whole space planning of it. We didn't actually have an architect, and it being a grade 2 star listed project was pretty tough. But I did have a surveyor that I worked with who handled the listed buildings people. Listed buildings is a whole different ballgame and opens up a major can of worms. So that was very challenging, and getting the spaces back and the ceilings back and putting the cornices back and designing, just bringing a little bit of modernity to it. That was just, I mean, it was a dream come true, actually, the project. And the client was great. There's the picture.
Wow.
So you can see that it's actually not furnished, the rest of it. But it was about bringing all the features back. We had to have all the panelling. We had to reincorporate it all. And, I mean, creating a space through a jib door to the master's sort of bathroom and dressing room. It was just amazing. And there was also a annex called the music room, and it's quite famous. It's protected by English heritage. And I would say that the proudest moment was restoring that, getting people, specialists in to restore it. And my daughter even helped paint some of it, which I was very proud that she was part of it. And it was a really, it was probably my most special. And then it led to this project just here that's on the screens now, that, that the client asked me to do his own home, this one. Wow. So that was rather lovely.
I think each project has, real high points, and there's nearly always a few low points as well.
Yeah.
I think planning can be a real issue, and it can seem really nonsensical, which is the frustrating part of it. We had a building that we were doing for a hotel, a country house hotel, which was really restricted in planning, and then it, you know, ended up being taken all the way to the Supreme Court, so things were delayed a lot, and that can make it difficult when you're, you know, trying to manage a team working on it alongside other projects. There, that was interesting because we had to layer in all the detailing like you're talking, and also the bits that you don't see in a hotel, all the acoustic treatments, all the M&E, getting everything en suite, getting everything air conditioned. But, you know, as you've both said, you learn so much in each project, which is a huge sort of, to me, a real perk of the job. There's always something unexpected and new.
You've sort of all described perhaps money no object briefs, where there's a huge challenge. What about when the budget's the brief? But the budget is the issue. How do you make something distinctive on, you know, perhaps less?
I would say the budget's always an issue.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
There's never, I've never been said, you know, here's my purse.
Go away, yeah, yeah.
So, definitely not. Everything always has to be approved, and, and you're always working to a particular budget. So sometimes I think from that point of view, you often have to sort of rob Peter to pay Paul, so you might spend a bit more on one thing and a little bit less on another. So no, it's to be honest, every project has a budget. So sometimes we do have some really tight budgets. There's one of the projects I've got up here where we were just told to try and just update something because it wasn't going to be their forever home. Whereas others are, you know, we've got one now that where the budget is enormous, absolutely enormous. But so the client might very well worry about something that's actually not worth worrying when you're spending that much on another, but it's all relative to the client. And
I think actually a restricted budget, although it feels like a pain at the time, can force some creativity it forces you to discover new suppliers and things that you hadn't thought of before. So there's usually always good that comes out of it.
Although
some of my team at the back might disagree with that.
I very often ask, usually I say to a client at the beginning of a project, do you have a budget in mind? And I don't know about you, but they usually say, not really. The reason they say that is because it's not because there's no upper limit. I think they're a bit worried about sort of saying more than you were thinking.
Yes.
And they want to get the feeling for the design first. And I think my first ever client said, I don't want to kill your creativity by giving you a budget. And I was like, fine, let's just do that.
Yeah.
But of course, usually what happens is the budget becomes apparent later in the process. Mm. When you've actually done the dream, costed it, and they go, so we don't want to spend all that. So then you go, okay, fine, so let's just, But I think it's very important when negotiating a budget at some point in the job, not to just chop the top off all the trees. You know, you should be spending a sort of crazy amount of money on doing that element of the job, even if it means deleting something else.
Yes,
otherwise, you end up with a kind of slightly bland, feeling to the project.
I would definitely agree with what Nicola was saying as well, because very often you've got a client who falls in love with something, but then you find out that it's just an arm and a leg. And so very often what we do is we go and then have something similar made, but we would never copy. You can't do that. It's kind of like a no-no in design, really, to go and copy somebody else's thing. Mm. But you might take some sort of inspiration from that piece and then develop something of your own from it. And that's really lovely because you often then have created something completely different for your client that just came from an inspiration. And then you're bang on budget as well, which is great. So win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your idea of... I'm sure there is such a thing. What is your idea of bad decorating? Is there anything you wouldn't do, a colour you wouldn't touch, a texture you just can't work with? Charles?
Not really. I mean, I had a client said to me once, I want to do a yellow bedroom. And my initial reaction to that was probably my mistake, was like, oh, God, yellow bedroom. But I thought, no, we're going to do it. So we used everything from yellowish browns to gold to lots of different tones of yellow. Mm. And we didn't use any other colour than that. And it was fantastic. And, you know, I always think that something that is yesterday's sort of bad taste can be always made to be today's cool thing. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that any sort of, you know, brassware in a bathroom in either gold or brass was just that... What are you talking about? No, of course, it has to be chrome or nickel.
Yeah.
And now, of course, that's like what everybody's doing.
Yeah.
And...
Coloured sanitary as well.
Yeah. Avocado sweet. There you go. Yes. That's the next, that's
back.
The next big thing.
It's back.
And I saw that... I always used to think those kind of little side tables covered in cloth were just like the... most dreadful thing. But I saw Kit Kemp's done one in her room upstairs now, and it kind of looks cute. And
yeah.
I sort of, I wouldn't necessarily do that, but I think the best thing is to take something that you think of as being dreadful, but find a new, different way of doing it and making it interesting and now.
It's interesting to say yellow, because I always think of yellow as being a tricky colour.
Yes.
But yellow is, everyone says, having a moment. We're about to come back again.
Yeah.
But it's a trend, so perhaps we're not going
to dwell on too. Well, I think it comes back to quality. I think if it's executed beautifully, then you know, absolutely, most things can find a place.
Yeah. What don't you do?
Well, I used to say I wouldn't do fake fur, but actually, you know, maybe I would. That's kind of everywhere at the moment. It comes back to quality. If something, you know, it has been done sort of cheaply, rushedly, corners have been cut, then it doesn't feel nice to be around.
Mm. And somebody said always have something in a room which is sort of slightly bad taste, because it kind of...
Yeah, but it lifts everything
else.
That's
a bit of fun. That adds a bit of fun. Why not?
Yeah.
I think for me, first and foremost, was never rip out anything historic from a building. So if there is a beautiful fireplace that's historic to that building, leave it there.
Yeah.
Work with it, you know, obviously... let it be beautiful, that would be nice. But so that's first and foremost for me. And then I think some funny little ones, I really hate short curtains, and I also really hate a chopped cushion.
A chopped cushion.
Oh, I see.
Okay. You're one of my clients.
Oh, don't do it, people.
And can I just say...
I don't like that. I want them to be, you know, squishy and comfortable and look lived in.
I agree with you. And there's something else I've seen. I think it's an American thing. And I'm a big fan of American design, by the way. But there's something I've seen in some American Instagram posts recently, which I think looks absolutely horrendous. But so much so that I'm thinking, I might actually have to do that now.
Just for some
and
fun.
And it's gloss ceilings. I don't know if anybody else has seen this.
Well,
and I keep seeing these posts with gloss painted ceilings. And I'm looking, that looks so awful, but it could almost be good. So.
I actually think it could be, don't you? I actually think it could be. No, I've seen quite a few of those and thought, when am I going to get a chance to do that? So there you go. Don't look at my Instagram page.
Okay.
We've talked a lot about clients, what the clients brief was, but I'm very interested to hear about your three, or your personal style. So I think perhaps we could have a little bit of fun by playing Desert Island Interiors. So I'm going to strand you all, I think we all know the rules, I'm going to strand you all on a desert island with a very small space, and you know you're going there, so perhaps we could take a few things with us to create the kind of scheme that you would feel relaxed and comfortable with until rescue arrived. So, Nick, Georgina, start with you. What would you have?
Well, so that's an interesting one, because for me, if you were stranded on a beach, it would have to suit the fact that you were on a beach. You know? So it might not necessarily be my own personal style, because it would be all about that beach. So I think I'd definitely take... being stranded from and away from home, the first thing I take is lovely photographs of family and some of my treasured art pieces that I particularly love. I think I'd take those with me. And then definitely a beautiful rug to make it just nice and lovely. And there's some really beautiful outdoor rugs nowadays. And maybe lime wash the walls, a comfy chair with a good cushion, that sort of thing. But I think most of all, I'd want a feeling from home. So Yeah,
I think it's, for me, people have often said to me, what's the most important thing about interior design? And for me, weirdly, although I don't really tend to use lighting consultants, I've always said lighting is the most important thing.
I agree.
On the basis that you can design a wonderful room, but if it's lit badly, if the light's in the wrong place or an unflattering place, that's the end, really, of the thing. So for me, my desert island thing, I think I just have some of those little glowing globes, you know. So that in the evening, as the sun is setting, I don't feel like I'm on my own and I've got a glow of light, something like that. And, of course, comfort's very important. So I think I would have a big thing that's a combination between a bed and a sofa that I can just curl up in with my kind of big throw, and that's it. That's probably all I'd need, really.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah, I love the sound of that. For me, lighting, I was going to say exactly the same as where it, you know, really comes to life, a space. And lamps are crucial to a design, so I think I'd take some really lovely lamps with me, maybe less modern than the ones you're describing. I can kind of imagine a big Bedouin tent with sort of carpet strewn and... feeling really cosy and magical.
Yeah,
I think I'd like to be stranded. All of you, actually. Perhaps I'd like to open it up to the audience and say I'm sure you're all eager to find some more questions. So has anybody got any questions for the panel? Yes, hi.
Hello, is that working? Yeah. Have you ever had a client that their style is so not compatible with yours that you feel that you can't work with them for that reason, and perhaps because it would then reflect on your own style after the job?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have that. I think there was two clients that I've, you know, got into talks with, and then I've been the one to say, no, this isn't going to work. I mean, I've had it work the other way around, obviously. And one was that what they wanted to do was very sort of what I would sort of say gaudy, sort of faux Louis XIV type of thing. And it wasn't that I thought that that was awful. It's just that I thought, I don't think I can actually do that. And I know lots of people that would do it better and want to do it and enjoy doing it. So I just said, look, I'm going to just introduce you to somebody else that could probably do that. But I think it's usually, I think you can usually find a way if you like the client and if you think you've got some simpatico with the client. The only other one that I walked away from was an extremely wealthy client. But I went to 6 or 7 meetings and we never moved forward. That's really more the reason to walk away from a job. And, you know, I'll always remember... The audiovisual person was there and they were being quizzed about their markups. And as this meeting went on, I saw him collecting his papers together. And in the end, he stood up and said, listen, I wish you every luck with the job. I'm just not going to be part of it. And just headed out of the door. Yeah. And I thought, well, I'm not going to be far behind you. And I wasn't. Yeah. I wasn't. So knowing when to walk away is an extremely important talent to have.
I've definitely had one like that.
So,
yeah, I was instructed to work on a property in Sandbanks. And it was a very, very over-the-top house, but the client wanted to make it even more so. And I did actually deliver. We delivered. I can see Nelly over there, part of my team. Absolutely. I mean, like you, we couldn't move it forward, but we did deliver all the kitchen design, we delivered all the joinery design, we got that far, and then it was just so over the top and so gaudy, I didn't actually know how to do it. And I just, in the end, made it his idea that I was not the right person and extracted myself very carefully. And, yeah, I probably did him a favour because I really wasn't right for the job. So...
I find it very difficult to walk away from things. Yeah. I so desperately want to give people what they want. And we've been incredibly lucky with our clients. And we do work on projects that are very sort of radically different. I mean, this is some of our work on here now, which is more on the kind of classical side. But we're doing stuff for student housing, which is incredibly modern and sort of poppy. So far, we haven't had anything that we've had to walk away from.
Any other questions? No?
Anyone?
Still got a few minutes left. Sure, you've got some burning thoughts.
There's only one question, but it was a very good question.
Yeah, very good.
Good.
Well, before we close, perhaps if we could leave the audience with one final thought, either a design hack or a decorating trick or a fabulous fabric or a colour combo, just something to take home that you think would be a good thing for them to share with their friends tonight. One thing each. What would that be?
Wow.
Mine is... do you want to go?
No, well, I was just going to say, I think the point that you made earlier about... not taking a blanket axe, you know, having some things that are real investment pieces, and then some things that are really, really cheap, you know, IKEA, Swoon, Made, you know, get some really good bedside tables, for example, but then, you know, invest in a killer headboard.
Shake it up,
yeah.
Yeah.
One thing that I've used quite a lot, especially in small apartments, is to do one wall of a corridor or a room entirely in mirror, because you have to do the whole wall, and it doesn't matter if you have joins, but you essentially you double the size of the space, and it can work in any room, but the way it works best is when you don't think of it as mirror, you just think of it as more space and more light being reflected. And it's a bit of an old trick, but it really does work. I've done it down a huge long corridor which felt a little bit claustrophobic. I've done it in all sorts of instances, but it's not that expensive. It's more tricky than it looks, because you have to make sure that the walls are flat, otherwise you end up with this awful thing sticking out over the skirting board. But if you can get it right, it's a really good hack, and it does make a small space feel twice the size, essentially.
I think my biggest piece of advice was that most of all, have some fun. And I think use colour. Don't be frightened of colour. You know, I was asked the other day about a little, just, you know, as a favour, some advice about colour. All on WhatsApp, by the way. And I just said, well, she said to me, oh, I'm thinking of doing it all, like, this room in grey, and then maybe I'll do this room grey too, and that room grey. And I said, why has it all gone grey? Have you looked at this one? Why don't you mix it up a bit? Have you looked? If you like grey, there's some really lovely blue greys and lovely pink, dirty pinks and stuff like that. So here are the names of a few paints, and think about those. So, you know, have some fun. And if you love something, have the confidence to go with it.
Yeah, if you love it, it works.
If you love it, it will work. Yeah.
Fantastic. So that's it. Great advice. So three things to take home tonight. Do it with colour, do it with mirrors, and shake things up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I have some water now.
Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you to Neil, Georgina, Charles and Nicola for such a thought-provoking and illuminating conversation. I think they have given us something, plenty to think about, and such a personal insight into creating inspiring spaces. We've had being timeless, mixing modern with the old, combining colour, pattern, honesty, playfulness. You shared some great advice about understanding and managing your client and knowing when you've been given the look, as Charles said, and you've been very honest about your biggest challenges, from teak junks in Hong Kong to listed buildings. So I think we have loved exploring how they bring their individual flair to design and decoration, and I would ask you to join me in thanking them. Thank you.